Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 165 on why suburban office buildings are a great investment with Brian C. Adams. If you're into real estate investing and building wealth, congratulations, you're in the right place. My role here on the REI Diamonds Show is to invite guests who specialize in building wealth, such as real estate investors and industry service providers, and draw out the jewels of wisdom, those tactics, mindsets, and methods used to create millions of dollars and more in the business of real estate. Today's guest, Brian Adams of Excelsior Capital, joins us here to discuss his unique perspective on post-COVID commercial real estate and why he is specifically bullish on and continuing to buy suburban office properties. Brian is the president and founder of Excelsior Capital, where he spearheads the investor relations and capital markets arm of the firm. He has 10 years of experience in real estate, private equity, and has advanced knowledge in best practices for strategic real estate investing. Prior to forming Excelsior Capital, Brian co-founded Prium Properties, that is an institutional real estate private equity sponsor, in 2010 and provided leadership and direction for that firm in connection with capital markets, investment management, and investor relations. He has served on the board of Serum Partners LP, a single family office investing across private and public asset classes since May of 2008. And since May of 2017, he has served on the investment committee for Solidus LP, that is an early stage venture capital firm focused on investment opportunities in healthcare and technology. And I share all this prior to our episode beginning to highlight the institutional nature of Brian's perspective, which you will notice as our conversation unfolds. Brian has raised more than $65 million in equity on a deal-by-deal basis, implementing his investment philosophy with patience and a very detailed market and asset selection process, as you'll also notice in a minute. Without further ado, let's get on with the show. All right. Welcome, Brian Adams, to the REI Diamond Show. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on.
For sure. I like to give a little context before each show and kind of report where in the world each guest is recording from. I'm in Chicago, as our regular listeners know. I record almost all of my episodes here where I live in Chicago. But where about in the world are you located in your home base of operation, Brian?
Nashville, Tennessee.
Nice, nice. Nashville, Tennessee. And I guess we'll follow that up with the Reader's Digest version about how you got to where you're at and what your business looks like today.
Perfect. Yeah, so I am a New Yorker who married a native Nashville girl, met up in college in Connecticut, and did the Northeast thing for a bit. Went to law school in Boston and then moved to Nashville 15 years ago. My wife's family has a single family office here in Middle Tennessee. And I practiced law for a number of years, actually as a prosecutor, and then got into the commercial real estate business through my wife's family. They had invested with various sponsors and GPs and done some direct co-investment over the last 25, 35 years. So kind of fell in love with the business, had an entrepreneurial itch, joined up with another New York guy that married a Nashville girl, and we started our company 10 years ago or thereabouts.
For context for the listeners, can you just like describe a bit more about what the family office is and then maybe even tie that in, because I think this is a big part of what you are doing now as an operator is kind of a symbiotic relationship with them. But I think that might be something worth just kind of providing a little bit of the basic definition and details of.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So a family office is a a partnership, and then they have various different legal vehicles, but essentially it's like a small investment business or fund or management company purely for the benefit of the family members themselves. So if you have a set amount of wealth to justify that kind of structure, it can kind of go in many different ways. There's an adage within the family office community that once you've met one family office, you have met one family office. And so it's become more commonplace to use the terminology. And what I tell people is, you know, family offices are just like families. They're all crazy and schizophrenic, but family offices just have a lot more zeros behind their number. But fundamentally, you have the same kind of challenges and questions that everyone does. But the goal is to create a corpus of assets that can provide multi-generational wealth to maintain a quality of life for, you know, the various members of the family. So that's my kind of poor job at describing what a family office is. But in terms of kind of how I evolved in my company, we initially started raising kind of some small blind pool commingled funds from friends and family. And it was fine. I mean, it's tough to raise those type of investment products, frankly. But probably about 5-6 years ago, we started doing direct co-investment on a deal-by-deal basis, more of a syndication model. Initially, it was the investors in the funds themselves. And then over time, we started branching out to third-party relationships. And that's frankly really when our company started to scale pretty quickly. And we were able to raise a decent amount of capital. Probably in the span of 4 years, we raised about $60, $65 million of equity and bought roughly 2 million square feet of commercial real estate. I made a lot of mistakes. One of the biggest mistakes I made was not scaling that business appropriately from a back office perspective. So we can kind of get into the mistakes and how I have tried to right those mistakes and hopefully tell people not to repeat them. But to your initial question about how the family office interplays with the company I started, when we began syndicating on a deal-by-deal basis, instead of just telling people what I was doing and thinking my product was the best, I actually started listening to what they wanted, what their pain points were. And for high-net-worth individuals and families, it was really, you know, they wanted a place where they could park their capital in a safe manner, typically in a real asset. They wanted to achieve some kind of yield income generation in a passive form, because if you think about a family, there's a lot of fixed costs associated with that. And so they're always looking for some kind of yield component, and bond market's been tough. Fixed income has been tough. And so real estate was one of the places they could get that yield. And then there's a whole lot you can do from the tax perspective to really accentuate the benefits of direct real estate ownership through your K-1. And a lot of general partners and sponsors either were not focused on those tax advantages, or they had non-taxable investors in their funds or deals, and they were really driving the ship on after-tax net of fee returns, which for a taxable investor is, I think, probably the most important aspect of doing private equity in real estate. So I've kind of pivoted the company to address the pain points of our investor base, which are high net worth individuals and families.
Nice. A lot of great stuff there. Forgive my silence. I do these audio only call-in teleseminars in the world of Zoom for specifically the reason so that I could bring my full attention to what our conversation is, make notes, take notes, and then refer back. So I'm taking those notes here, and we got a lot of good stuff. So you mentioned, Brian, the direct co-investments. Were they direct co-investments with other family offices, or just like third-party introductions to other high net worth individuals? Like, what about that was a pivot and turning point for you in your career, your company's career?
In terms of how to grow or how to access those new relationships?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned direct co-investments, and I'm not really sure exactly what they were.
Instead of committing to a fund, the vehicle, or me telling you this is what my plan is or this is what my investment thesis is. I was telling people, hey, this building is under contract. We need to raise X amount of money on just this one particular asset and just this one opportunity. And instead of you thinking about committing to a fund where I call down capital over a 3-year period, you can underwrite the risk on this one particular asset and take a rifle shot approach and make sure that the timing makes sense for you, whether you want to allocate to real estate, whether you want to take a risk or not take a risk. And you can underwrite to that risk and timing for that particular deal, as opposed to committing to a 10-year fund that you're not sure exactly what it's going to buy or when it's going to buy it. That was just a much better fit for my investor base.
And the third party relationships that you had, were these other funds, just high net worth individuals? Who were the third parties relationships that were also part of that?
Yeah, it was people in my network who, for whatever reason, I hadn't reached out to about the fund vehicle itself. And it just had this massive network effect where you have an investor that comes and looks at an opportunity. He talks to a friend or she talks to a coworker, or a colleague, and then it just kind of expands from there. And what I found was there's really just a paucity of investment opportunities within the commercial real estate space between being able to participate in a REIT investment, which I think is a really poor proxy for real estate, or having to participate in this big KKR, Carlyle, Wall Street fund of funds where there's no relationship with the management team, the fees are heavy, it's very opaque. There was nothing really in that middle market. And so I wanted to create a solution to kind of solve those problems for people.
It's a very interesting perspective, and I was excited to have you on the show when we started the first exchange emails, Brian, because you bring a high net worth experience level, and it's kind of like another notch up. Like the listeners who've been tuned into the show for a long time have heard many other guests come on with the single asset risk profile, raising money for this specific asset. Like this is actually a lot of the guests have specifically started out and done that. But typically the trajectory of those guests from my knowledge interaction with them has been more of a coming from the physical real estate side of things like myself. I mean, I buy and sell houses. We started by raising, enough money to flip one house as opposed to this like institutional mindset that you come from. So I think it's a unique perspective that you're bringing and it's kind of exciting. As you mentioned off these couple things, the REIT, I have some money in REITs and you're right. The one thing I do like about, investing in a REIT is it's completely hands off. It's, set it and forget it. It's that passive aspect that you had mentioned about what the family offices want. And, I don't have a family office, but I am a passive, high net worth investor and I'm looking for those same similar things like you talked about. And I have no experience whatsoever and am nowhere near qualified to be considered to invest in one of the KKR or any other, private equity. I don't know what's, type of capital would be required to participate in something like that. I'm excluded because I don't have enough. So, I guess my observation is it's great for the listeners and for you to bring that, institutional angle of investing and kind of come from that angle to then come to this single asset, raising money on this specific deal as opposed to, raising $100 million and we're setting out to buy XYZ that's in our investment philosophy over the next 3 or 4 year period. Versus the entrepreneurial, scrappy, always raising for the one investment that I think a lot of people are accustomed to and used to. And I think that high level of thinking has probably helped you out pretty far. I think we were talking early on, if I'm not mistaken. So right now for listeners, we're like mid-October 2020 and we're coming out of we're still in the middle of the COVID pandemic, but we were talking, you and I, before our episode started, Brian, about the debt markets and the ability to not do deals for the last several months, which I think a lot of people in real estate and probably many other businesses around the world have had our hands shackled in uncertainty through the pandemic, and we're finally starting to evolve to the new world, the way the world works again now. And some of the trends that you had mentioned previously, which I'm sure you're going to touch on here, like the suburban office space as an example. But also, if you don't mind, I guess my direct question is starting with point would be, what happened with the debt markets in your world, and what assets are you now focused on, and maybe you were focusing on? Is that anything different now because of COVID, or are you still following the same course of action as we proceed through the rest of 2020?
Sure. So if you look at Q1, for example, we were set to close on an acquisition of an office building in Kansas City in mid-April, early April. We had everything done. Diligence was complete. We were just looking to, you know, do the paperwork and get the lawyers to agree on whatever red lines they had. But what happened was, the spreads, so kind of what people were pricing in risk at, because the world went upside down, spreads blew out, right? Which means that, you know, if I in March was able to get a CMBS deal at 4%, spreads went all the way up to 6%, right? So it no longer underwrote for deals. And frankly, the whole credit market seized up. So everyone basically said, no new deals. We're not going to issue term sheets, and anything that's midstream, we're no longer going to pursue this, because they couldn't price in the risk because there just was so many unknowns. And so the CMBS market effectively locked up for, call it, 3 to 4 months. Now it has come back. And interestingly, we bought that building that we were set to close in April in June with a regional lender, with a bank lender. And then we're refining it with the same CMBS group that we were originally going to buy it with in April. And pricing is the same for the most part. So it has come around. I would say, obviously, a lot of lenders, as you would anticipate, are just not touching retail and hospitality. And some major urban metro office deals are no longer something that credit committee wants to do any longer. So I think it's a fundamental deal that still has good legs, and the underwriting is solid. You'll find debt for it, but for a period of time, nothing happened. So that was the first time that I had experienced that in my career, since I was not in the business during 08.
Yeah, not an interesting thing to go through, right?
Yeah, but, you know, I will say that it's a learning experience, and it's important for a sponsor and GP. And the lesson I took away is, CMBS and Life Co are great because the economics are very good. The rates are going to be terrific. But when you actually need help, they are not going to answer the phone. Your regional community bank probably will. And so from everything from kind of processing the PPP loans to getting this bridge deal done, that's where these deeper, longer held relationships and the folks that you see at the country club or at your kid's school, I mean, they came to the rescue, right? And so I think it's important to always kind of maintain those relationships and have two or three of those folks in your back pocket, because when things go sideways, the Wall Street guys, they are at the Hamptons and their phone's off. But these local relationships, they want to work with you, and that's where they kind of earn their fee, in my opinion. And so that was a really good lesson for me. To keep in mind moving forward as I continue on my career.
Gotcha. Let's talk about that office deal. I think a lot of people would, you know, say, well, wait a minute, Brian, you're telling me that you just bought an office building, but everybody is at home now, working from home. And, you know, the biggest companies in Silicon Valley have now dismissed their workforce to work from home. Can you talk about the trend and justify that? I mean, if I were an investor in that fund that I'm getting ready to wire over $100,000 to put into that deal, how do you talk me off the ledge compared to what everyone's saying in the media?
Yeah, sure. And we were actually oversubscribed on that acquisition, and we just went under LOI in a new office acquisition. So, listen, I think we're all suffer from recency bias. To some extent, we think the way that we've lived the last 6 months is going to be the way that we live the next 6 years. And that's certainly not true. So if you have an investment thesis and it's grounded in data points and it's grounded in demographics, and you'll be able to look back at historical information, call it over the last 25 years, I think you need to have the gumption and be resolute in deploying capital in a methodical fashion. So obviously COVID is changing how we use the office, but to say that it's going to cause a secular shift in office as a viable asset class over the next 10 years, I think is just a bridge too far. So pre-COVID, 4% of the workforce worked remotely. Certainly in a post-COVID world, it will be more than 4% of the workforce. But here's where it's really important to delineate between working from home and remote work, right? Working from home 100% of the time for entire organizations and corporate users is just unrealistic, in my opinion. You can't maintain culture. You can't have productivity. You can't have creativity. And you certainly can't onboard new employees on a purely work from home basis. So I think what you'll see is a shift to a hub and spoke model where folks will be able to work remote, which means that as opposed to being in the Bay Area or Midtown Manhattan, they're going to be spread across various other secondary support offices. And frankly, most of them are going to be suburban office. So when I think about office, the way we use it, I think will change. Over the last 10 years, there was this huge trend line towards mass densification and really expensive build out. So think a WeWork in a really hip, cool area of New York City where the average square foot per user was 75 square feet. And the TI build out in terms of how much money went into building out those spaces was astronomical. I think there'll be a shift in the pendulum in the other direction. It'll be a return towards more of a traditional office layout, which is typically 250 to 300 square foot per employee. And a lot of corporate users, even the big ones, are going to be very cognizant of how much money they're spending on overhead. And typically lease costs are one of the higher fixed cost liabilities that these users have. And so suburban office, when you think about the ability to handle the density, the ability to be a more affordable option, and frankly, a factor that not a lot of people talk about is you also have to have the ability to park that much densification because none of these markets have mass transit options. So when you kind of take all that into account, the short answer is I don't know what's going to happen with office in the long term, but I do know in the near term, people are still going to use it and it's going to be a necessary part of how we kind of conduct business moving forward. And across our 2.5 million square feet, we've had roughly 93% rent collection. We've had a few rent relief requests. We've been able to manage those. But again, I think it's too knee-jerk to say that there's a death of office. And if you actually look at the press releases of what some of those tech companies are saying, and you look at what the leasing activity is on those tech companies, you can see that they continue to expand their office footprint. Facebook just did a 700,000 square foot deal in downtown New York. Twitter said that everyone's going to work from home, but they're actually expanding in Denver, Austin, and other places. Amazon's doing the same thing. They just announced, I think, $1.4 billion of real estate office deals. So I would be wary of what you read in the headlines, and I would actually dig into what the data points tell you. And honestly, if you take a step back and think, okay, what asset classes in real estate are going to benefit from this demographic shift away from these expensive coastal markets? Single family housing, suburban office, retail distribution are all going to benefit. Because if at the end of the day, commercial real estate across any food group on the spectrum, it's about population growth, wage growth, and job creation. And those things are all happening in secondary markets and interior markets in the Midwest and along the Sun Belt in the Southeast.
Yeah, I'd agree 100%, Brian. Our experience as a company, Diamond Equity Investments, my house flipping company, we did 223 houses last year. We had like 100 houses under contract, owned, under construction. And, you know, when COVID hit and all of a sudden we couldn't even have contractors go work on the houses. And so it was very, very uncomfortable situation. And we took a few haircuts and got a few of them to closing as we got through there. But we came out of it rip-roaring. And it's the same thing that you're talking about. Number one, over the past two,
to 3-year period. We're in Atlanta, we're in Philadelphia, we're in Chicago, and we had an office first in Atlanta. We kind of had one in Philly years ago. I started back in 2006 and was kind of like, you know, inching along before we hit our growth stride here over the last 5, 6, 7 years. But in the last 3-year period, we intentionally opened up 4 office spaces throughout those 3 cities. And the same things you talked about, the creativity, the productivity, the efficiency, the culture, right? We put a lot of focus on our culture as we've grown. I think 55% was our growth last year, and we grew like 20 to 30% the year before. And we're on pace to grow at least 30 to 40% this year, maybe even more than that. As a result of that, and I could point to the office, Brian, I could point to the office and say, opening offices is a humongous linchpin in the lever of our growth over the past 3 or 4 years for those same reasons that you talked about. And it's kind of along, you know, it's kind of along the same lines that you're talking about. If I was going to agree with the trend even more, here we are with COVID. People are afraid to be within 4 or 5 or 6 feet of people. And so we're all naturally stepping back, taking a step back. And so to go from 75 square feet per employee to 250 or 300, like, people are really wanting space right now. And I couldn't agree more with you as we look at the, you know, the rebirth of suburban office, and we start to see a lot of people moving out of the downtown areas. It is kind of a,
I completely agree.
It's kind of a demographic shift that we also witness. I was bullish all the way through COVID and saying that, you know, the demographics of our millennial population reaching home buying years is pushing the single family real estate space where we operate, and gave me the gumption to put, you know, full investment on the line back in March, April, and May as we were shut down. That same demographic is, albeit getting married a little bit later and having kids a little bit later, but likely the same demographic that's going to be putting houses up for sale in downtown Chicago and downtown Philly as they're kind of growing out of these smaller inner city homes and wanting to be out there in the suburbs, right? Living near the same suburban offices that you're currently bullish on as we speak here in 2020, right?
100%. And I think when investors and individuals and families are looking at private commercial real estate deals, the concept of a risk-adjusted return is a really important one, right? So if you want to be completely insulated and just have no risk, then yeah, you should buy an Amazon distribution facility that's brand new construction in Texas. But you're going to be buying it at a 3 cap. So you're not going to be able to really cover your debt. You'll maybe get a little bit cash flow, it'll be nominal, and you're just kind of hoping for appreciation. So I think if you look at the spectrum of real estate opportunities, I personally think you need to be close to an 8% cash on cash yield in order to justify the illiquidity premium and the risk you're taking on doing a private deal. And office and single family are some of the only asset classes where you can probably do that, frankly, right now. Because retail and hospitality are suffering a lot of pain. But the other side of the equation is a lot of these kind of data center or self-storage or other type of very safe insulated products, I don't think they're really appropriate for individuals who need current cash flow and passive income, because you're just not going to get it on a cap rate basis. So I think that's kind of an important factor to take into consideration. And then to your point about this millennial shift, yeah, I mean, if you read the newspaper 2-3 years ago, it seemed like millennials were going to be living in Brooklyn, wearing skinny jeans, eating avocado toast, and never having children in their entire lives. Because of the Great Recession in 2008, their typical family formation age got pushed back from the late 20s, early 30s into the mid 30s and late 30s. And so this COVID has really accelerated a trend that we were seeing before, which is millennials are getting married, they are having children, and increasingly making choices about where they want to live, work, and play based on quality of life, cost of living, access to single family homes, and access to education for their children. And so these secondary growth markets that have, you know, really robust suburbs and good school districts, I think you'll see them continue to outperform.
what would you define the secondary growth market as? Is this certain secondary cities? Are these the, you know, the tertiary counties that surround downtowns? Like, what are the actual areas that you favor when you're looking at these markets?
Yeah, so we think of it as right around a million people plus on an MSA basis, but outside the traditional top 10 gateway markets. So you've kind of got that middle ground of they're not tertiary. So kind of liquidity concerns crop up for me on the tertiary side. But those bigger gateway markets, especially the ones that are in these coastal democratically held markets, I think are going to have a tough 5+ years. So that's how we defined it. We actually have a matrix where if the MSA qualifies from a population standpoint, then we look at year over year wage growth, job growth, population growth, and then we kind of dive in from there and look at it on a sub-market basis. Because if you're in Atlanta, then you can understand this concept. A lot of these markets have no geophysical barriers. And so the sprawl and the spread can be extensive. And the different sub-market dynamics between one end of the city to the other end of the city, which could be an hour-plus car ride, you might as well be talking about completely different cities. So we do a lot on the data analytics side to understand exactly what neighborhood we want to be in and even what kind of cross street we want to be on.
Do you typically select the neighborhood before you look at the asset, or are you looking at a stream of assets crossing your desk at the company there and then seeing if it fits within the matrix? Basically, do you start with the neighborhood or do you start with the asset when you're looking at acquisition targets?
We go top down. So we look at the MSA and then we pick two submarkets that we would consider transacting at. And then we go from there and we just carpet bomb that submarket and find deals that fit within our matrix. So we look at it the other way.
Gotcha. So you're selecting the market first because it's kind of more of a broad risk and expected return based on your belief in those specific markets that you find, and then you're looking for the assets that are located in there. So in a sense, it would be like selecting stocks. I want to be in tech. I want to be in tech that's advertising, and then I'm now looking at, say, Facebook, something of that nature if we're kind of
I think that's a fine analogy. We look at MSAs that we like. We kind of like Eds and Meds investment thesis, so markets that have really strong educational anchors, either in the market or very close by. So let's use Kansas City as an example because we've been active there. Lawrence, Kansas, where University of Kansas is probably 20, 30 minutes away. So that's a big draw. And then we like healthcare as a kind of resilient cyclical industry to be involved in. And so Kansas City has Cerner, which is this huge healthcare company that's headquartered there. And obviously has a bunch of ancillary add-ons there. So then we look at the submarket. So what neighborhood that we would go to, and pre-COVID, we looked at 08, kind of looked at how that submarket behaved. We probably wouldn't go to a submarket that experienced more than a 12% vacancy rate during the downturn. Because that's kind of how we stress test the asset and how it performs. And then we have all kinds of data points that we use in terms of price per square foot, cap rate, discount to replacement cost, discount to replacement rent. We like stabilized cash flowing deals. And so when you kind of put all that through the sieve, your opportunity set gets pretty small, but that's fine with us. We're one of the reasons I like doing a deal by deal company as opposed to a fund is I don't really have an obligation to put money to work in order to make my fee. I do deals when I find attractive opportunities and I participate in them personally. And so I think that's a better way to go about buying these type of assets. And honestly, what I've realized after doing this 10 years, raising capital deal by deal, I think it's healthy for a manager and a GP sponsor, because if it's a good deal, you'll raise on it. But if it's not a good deal or if it's got issues and you've got sophisticated investors, you'll figure it out probably within a week or two of pitching the deal. And we've walked after some of our investors have pointed some things out that we've missed. And so I like that aspect of it too, that I've got to really sharpen my pencil every deal that I do. Otherwise I won't be able to close.
Yeah, that is interesting that you have this, in a sense, a fail-safe of the sophisticated investors who oftentimes probably participated in some great number of deals, potentially many deals in your space or a similar space, long before you came along. So it's in a sense, having those additional partners gives you this backstop of experience to pick out potential problems maybe that you never encountered before, right?
Exactly.
I also like the deal by deal. I never really thought of it this way versus a fund because, like I said, so many people that I've heard of and know, this is just how it's done, is deal by deal. But in a sense, you're right. If you have a fund, all of a sudden you're in the position of being a motivated buyer. Not a good situation. Myself personally, Brian, I did a 1031 exchange. I lucked out and got a fair deal, but it was not the kind of deal that would have been a home run, and I probably would have sat that deal out if it came across my desk, and I was not in the motivated buyer situation of having to find a home for that money with the deadline and the clock ticking, same way that a fund manager may have some similar motivating factor to get them to put that money to work in a faster period of time. I bought the deal. I'm making money on the deal, and it's a decent deal, but it wasn't really going to give me the type of patience that Warren Buffett has to be able to sit on the sidelines with cash and not put it to work, like you described having that same similar patience on a deal-by-deal raise structure that you're currently operating.
Yeah, I think having discretionary capital is kind of the golden egg that everyone reaches for when they're a fundless sponsor or GP, but I think it's really problematic structurally. Unless you're truly an institutional manager. And I get that question a lot from my investor base. You know, I've got this 1031 money. What should I do? And they oftentimes, to your point, they try to put a square peg in a round hole. I'm certainly not a CPA, but my unsolicited advice is typically, listen, if the timing works and the deal looks good and you would do the deal regardless of the tax benefits, then you should do it. But if you're trying to cram this thing down, you should just eat the tax and wait for a good deal to come around. Cause you don't want the tail to wag the dog. And that was, I don't want to get into a whole different kettle of fish, but that was a big issue that I had with this whole opportunity zone structure was a lot of people did these things just for the tax reasons. And I just don't think that's the right way to do real estate.
Yeah, I remember a couple places in Philadelphia, and I'm not going to stay on it very long, but we had like a Keystone Opportunity Zone, a local Philadelphia, Pennsylvania kind of a thing. Man, it's been like 20 years, and those neighborhoods still feel identical to when I first started. I mean, I guess it's 15 years. It was 2006 when I got into business, so 14, 15 years. I'm exaggerating by a few, but it didn't seem like it was having the kind of impact, the very similar tax structure to the Opportunity Zones. But anyway, we're on tax advantages as sort of a topic right now. High net worth individuals who are participating in one or several of your deals, what about your deals tax advantage wise would be important and exciting for those investors who are coming to the table?
Yeah. Among my many mistakes that I made throughout my career, a top three mistake would be not paying for a best-in-class internal controller bookkeeper. I think outsourcing it is problematic, probably necessary for some, you know, out-of-the-gate entrepreneur folks, but when you can afford it, you should overpay for really good talent. So what I've done through this iteration was I hired a CPA with a public accounting tax background in-house. And he can't give tax advice to our investors, but he can really hold our third-party relationships to task and make sure we're doing everything that we can on the tax side to kind of increase the benefits and take full stock of all the benefits that you get from real estate ownership. So it's not complicated, but, you know, not everyone does these things. You can do accelerated bonus depreciation on the asset the minute that you buy it. You can conduct cost segregation analysis to help aid that accelerated depreciation. And you can characterize the initial dividends as a return of capital as opposed to a distribution, so it's a non-taxable event. So what we essentially try to achieve is being able to show a loss on your K-1 for hopefully years 1, 2, maybe 3 while giving you a 10% cash on cash yield. Because that's just extremely powerful, because you can offset gains elsewhere with those losses, and that after tax income can be significant.
And the 10% yield is also structured as a return of capital, so it's not a taxable income event, right?
Correct. Until you get 100% of your original capital commitment back, and then it'll be considered distributions. But yeah, it's simply just the way that you characterize it. It has huge implications on your K-1 though.
What are the typical return of capital? Just give me an example on a deal that you've done. You know, bought it, we want to sell it in 5 years, bought it, want to keep it forever and ever and a day. You know, what's like the long-term investment philosophy look like for you?
Yeah, and again, this is really a direct result of what my investors want. And for the most part, if I find them a really nice asset that's stabilized, cash flowing, that I think has, you know, good long-term ability to continue to make distributions, unless I'm going to hit a really big multiple on invested capital, my investors would, for the most part, just prefer to continue to get those distributions and not sell the asset, because they may not have anything terribly productive to do with that capital to replace on an investment basis. And frankly, most of my investors can't take IRR to their beach home or to their tuition payments or to pay for their second car, et cetera. They want cash. They want real money in the door. So our concept is, we tell people it's going to be a 10-year hold. And if we sell it beforehand and it's a good return, that's great. But they should consider this a long-term illiquid hold.
Gotcha. Are there any other questions about your fund, the recent deals, your company that I did not have the foresight to ask, but you might want to answer for listeners?
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate that question. I think we covered a lot of ground. You know, we continue to find opportunities. I'd say we typically do 4 acquisitions a year, kind of depending. So we currently have a couple of things in the hopper that we're excited about. But you know, I think we cover the most things. And for me, doing these type of interviews or events, you know, regardless if you want to do one of my deals or not, I'd love the chance to connect with you and just make sure that the sponsor you're working with is doing everything that's considered best in class from an investor relations, communications, marketing, and tax side. Because I think a lot of mistakes investors make, as well as sponsors, is understanding, and this took me a while to figure out, there's the deals themselves, right? Like, you have to find the right house and you've got to put your expertise to work and you've got to use your kind of craft to make money in that investment. But then there's a whole another part of the business, which is just kind of operating the business itself. And they're two separate things. The risk related to the real estate, listen, if you're an accredited investor and you're doing a private placement deal, you're acknowledging that risk and you hope the sponsor does a great job and they're going to work hard, but you don't know, right? I mean, that's why you're getting an outsized return from taking that risk. But in terms of how they operate the company themselves, that is something that you can really control a lot of the risks on the front end by asking a couple of questions and doing a little bit of homework. And you can, in my opinion, really take down the risk profile from an investment standpoint on the company side. And so I think that's an important distinction to make, both as a sponsor and an investor, if that makes sense.
Do you have an example of the questions you would ask if you were getting ready to participate in a deal?
Sure. I mean, you can talk about track record and all that kind of thing, but I think on the infrastructure side, it's, you know, do you have an investor portal? Is it best in class? Do you send out monthly financials? What are the expectations on a quarterly basis? Are K-1s going to be early? It's being clear on the experience side of, and I've started doing this a lot more as a GP, because I'm at a point now in my career where I have a strict no-jerk investor policy, and not every investor is the right fit for what I do. And so I'm very clear with expectations on what you will get. You will get from me real-time monthly financials. You will get a quarterly assessment on the asset as well as the market that that asset is in. Your K-1s will be early. You will have access 24/7, 365 to your investor portal, which will have historical financials, historical distributions. You can upload ACH information. You can change your contact, et cetera. Those are all things that you can expect from me. But you cannot call me on a Saturday afternoon. You cannot call me Sunday morning. And it's important to have those guardrails up, because if you don't, it's just a miscommunication. And so I think it's professional and frankly something that not a lot of people want to talk about. But understanding on the front end what that experience is going to look like, I think is really important to manage expectations. And ultimately, it will allow you hopefully time to just work the deals and run the company. So those are some of the questions that I would ask. And also, frankly, asking for a reference point on a current or prior investor, not a lot of people do it. And, you know, if you're a manager or a sponsor that can't produce two or three people that are going to say, you know, good things about you, that's pretty telling.
All right. Good stuff there. Solid, solid information. If anyone's listening and they're getting ready to invest, I would suggest rewinding the audio here another 2 minutes. I was writing very fast. I don't think I got it all, but there's a lot of gold there and a lot of solid information. Don't overlook what Brian just said. So, Brian, if you had an investor or maybe someone else in the real estate business ask you, hey, Brian, do you have like a good book or two that you could recommend I read so that I could come up the curve on this or any other topics you felt were valuable?
Yeah, I'll do it from the sponsor GP perspective. So I personally think Give and Take by Adam Grant is just a terrific way to learn about how to network effectively, how to build that good karma, and understand kind of, in my opinion, how networking should work, which is basically just kind of give it forward, give away everything for free, and it will always come back to you in some form or fashion. And essentially divide the words into givers and takers, and, you know, you, not to spoil the end conclusion, but you want to surround yourself with givers and not takers in order to kind of make your life a more interesting and rich place. And then To Sell as Human, I think a lot of mistakes that, and I think it's by Thomas Pink. You can look at it on Amazon, but a lot of first-time entrepreneurs in real estate or not in real estate, when they come and ask me for, you know, free advice, I say, okay, well, you're going to raise this money. What are you going to do with it? And they say, oh, I'm going to hire a chief marketing officer. I'm going to get a sales guy. No, wrong. If you're not comfortable talking about your product all day, every day, and having a bunch of people tell you you're crazy and say, tell you no, this is not the business for you. And you just have to get comfortable with that, because this is part of it, is going out there, putting yourself at risk, putting yourself out where you probably don't feel comfortable. And you're going to get a lot of people that just tell you no, that tell you you're crazy, that don't respond to you. And you just got to have a short memory. You've got to continue to tell your story, continue to build that content, build that good karma, and it will come back. But I mean, you've got to be realistic about your conversion percentages and your numbers. So unless you're going to be the chief sales officer as the entrepreneur and the principal, I think ultimately in a capital intensive business like real estate, you will fail.
Yeah, it probably is the same in a lot of other businesses too, I would only assume. But man, embracing sales early on has been one of the dividing lines I've seen in many, many, many people I've seen who are successful and highly successful at whatever it is they were doing versus the people who had the dream, maybe tried and sort of failed out. Like, get comfortable with selling. Get comfortable with that rejection. Don't be afraid to ask for the sale. I mean, if there's one persistent trait for my own personality that I intentionally developed, because I was not always good at asking for the sale and having that conversation, That ability that I developed years and years and years ago has paid more dividends than I'm capable of counting. So, Brian, if we could go back to when you were in law school and you could share with yourself the crown jewel of wisdom, what would that be?
Instead of coming up with a product that I think is cool and interesting, if you want a scalable business, you need to reverse engineer it and figure out what the marketplace wants as opposed to what you want to give them. Your life will be much easier.
Nice. So how can listeners get more information about you, Excelsior Capital, or even just connect?
Yeah, so I'm very active on LinkedIn. I post on a very consistent basis. And if you connect with me and you send me a message, I will talk to anybody about anything at any time. I'll always carve out time. So you can connect with me on LinkedIn or you can go to the website, excelsiorgp.com. And we have all kinds of content and resources there. We've been doing a lot of webinars and blog pieces about very technical real estate and then also some larger issues about just alternatives and private equity in general and best practices. So feel free to connect with us either way.
I was curious who actually does the writing because they were high quality, they did not appear like the copywritten, articles. These are high quality articles, basically. Did you write those yourself?
Some I have, but I also have a team internally. We have a marketing person, and then I've got an investor relations development person as well. And one of the other lessons I've learned is, I think in our business, when you're working with investors, we're not in the wealth management business. We're not trying to kind of get all their AUM. We're just kind of a slice of their overall financial life. But the more that you can be a resource for them and educate them about what else is out there in the world and what risks and opportunities might be there, I think it really does help kind of create you as a thought leader and ultimately will lead to more investor engagement. And so we've been very focused on just being a resource for people. We have a lot of investors who are in hotel deals and they're trying to figure out what they should or shouldn't do and what the options are and maybe working with a younger sponsor. And I'd say that during the lockdown, we did a lot of calls with our investors, just, hey, what can I do to help? Like, I've got somebody that might be able to help you out of this situation. And, you know, I think the more that you can do that, the better manager it makes you. And so that's where we spend a lot of our time, is kind of building that content, being a resource, being a place for investors to educate themselves about the space, in a very safe world. Cause not everyone feels comfortable saying that they don't know X, Y, or Z. So we try to afford them that kind of safe environment where they can learn at their own pace.
Nice. Well, hey, Brian, we've reached the top of our time here together. I've got a wealth of information here. I'm sure the listeners would agree with me. Thank you for giving us your time and sharing of your wisdom and coming on the REI Diamond Show.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This was a lot of fun.
And thank you for tuning in to the REI Diamond Show. Remember to give us a review, and subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Just search REI Diamonds and click subscribe. You can also sign up to receive new episode notification emails at www.reidiamonds.com, as well as check out the 163 episode archive of Wealth Building, Real Estate Investment Jewels of Wisdom. I've made millions of dollars by using the wisdom shared on the show over the last few years. That website, again, is reidiamonds.com. So my main business, Diamond Equity, is the business of buying and selling houses. 223 houses bought and sold in 2019, and 181 houses bought and sold so far in 2020. We currently have another 138 houses in inventory, either under construction, for sale, or sold and awaiting closing. So here are three ways that you and I could do business. Number one, if you buy houses in Atlanta, Chicago, or the Philadelphia regions, go to dealswithroi.com and sign up for the correct buyer's list there. Note there are 5 different lists in total, separated by region. Essentially, we offer our inventory pre-construction available for sale for other investors at wholesale pricing. So if that sounds good, go to dealswithroi.com. And number 2, if you are an accredited investor and you'd like to fund a deal or many deals, go to fundrehabdeals.com and sign up to receive private mortgage investment opportunity emails. And number 3, if you have a deal for sale in either Atlanta, Chicago, or the Philadelphia region, please send me an email with the details. I buy fix and flip single family investment deals, and I also buy turnkey multifamily deals. And today, actually, there's a 4th way we could do business. So I am currently in search of an A player or 2 A players to join me at Diamond Equity. To see the available positions we have, click the careers link at www.dealswithroi.com. We have reached the end. Next up, my friend and fellow Chicagoan, Scott Crone, joins us to share his self-storage redevelopment strategy. Self-storage is a favorite among investors for its historic performance during turbulent economic times, which are now upon us. So if safe, recession-proof assets and investments sound like a good idea to you, you should definitely catch that conversation with Scott. I will see you on the other side, my friend. Dan Breslin, signing off.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.